Hey everybody, welcome to the last damage report of the week. It is Friday. We are just on the cusp of the holiday week in which we are going to have, as we've been talking about throughout the week, a couple of very special episodes for you. Taking a look back through multiple different lenses at 2018. We're going to have an episode that will be an awards show where we give generally humorous but some serious awards for people who've done both good and bad things in America throughout the year. We're going to have our year in damage where we look back on the biggest stories that helped to shape the year. And we also have our interview special where we're going to be highlighting some of the best and most important interviews that we were able to conduct throughout the year, generally focused on things that were going on with the election. There are going to be some awesome recurring guests in that episode. There are also going to be some celebrity political activists. So if you potentially missed some of those interviews the first time around or want to take a look back on, you know, the way that we were thinking about politics at various points throughout the year, then you're going to want to tune in for those episodes coming out next week. We have, after today, only one more real episode on the 31st, our last episode of the year. A couple of great guests planned for that as well. So big news today, more to come next week, so buckle up. Throughout this hour, we're going to be going over a couple different elements of breaking news, some information that could potentially affect the future of Donald Trump's attorney general nominee, William Barr. Some information coming out about what he was getting up to earlier this year that might have influenced him being picked in the first place. Later on, if we have time, a story from, I think it was 1991 about Donald Trump, I think that perfectly showcases two things. One, how little he's actually changed in that time. And two, why he was able to craft the persona that he was in New York over the past couple of decades. We do have a guest who's going to be joining us later on in the hour. Great journalist who's done a lot of investigative reporting on Jeffrey Epstein and his various legal issues over the past few years. Going to be joining us to describe why it is that he's been able to mostly evade responsibility for what he's done, but also the pushback that she received in investigating his story, including attempts to bribe her into silence. So all that and more coming up. We're going to start off with some important domestic political news. William Barr is the pick from Donald Trump to be the next attorney general. But why did he pick him? I mean, William Barr is, he's a name in sort of the Republican establishment more, you know, a couple of decades ago than today, former attorney general. So I guess at least from the Republican point of view, he's got the qualifications, but he doesn't really seem, he's never seemed like the sort of person that Donald Trump would just pick. It's a safe pick. So a rational president, especially one who has so many, you know, scandals and legal problems and all that, might have picked him for just rational, hey, he's a known quantity reasons, but not Donald Trump. That's not how he picks people. When Donald Trump came out and said that he was his first pick, which was obviously a lie, he also said he's well respected. Donald Trump does not pick people because they're well respected. He describes people as well respected because he likes them. So I have been wondering this whole time, why actually would he pick William Barr? Now, there were a couple of sort of reasons around the edges. We know that William Barr had occasionally talked sort of peripherally just a little bit about the Mueller investigation and indicated that he was willing to criticize it, that his approach to it would not be, you know, what we would prefer or for anyone would prefer who wants to see the rule of law governing what the president is actually able to do. But it wasn't as strong as, say, Matthew Whitaker, the current acting AG. He had been much more critical of the Mueller investigation. And especially considering how there were no other qualifications for him to be in the position in the first place, it certainly seemed like that was the reason that Whitaker had been chosen, but not Barr. Up until today, because now we find out that earlier this year, William Barr actually wrote a completely unsolicited memo, a long memo, attacking, I would say, the very foundations of the Mueller investigation. So here's a little bit of what William Barr wrote. Mueller should not be able to demand that the president submit to an interrogation about alleged obstruction. If embraced by the department, this theory would have potentially disastrous implications, not just for the presidency, but for the executive branch as a whole and the department in particular. So I want to come at that quote from two different directions. So first of all, what Barr is actually intentionally saying there is absurd and I would say insane. The idea that a president cannot be asked about obstruction of justice by a special counsel, considering the specific contextual historical situation vis-a-vis special counsels and presidents, One of the reasons we have the special counsel thing now is because presidents obstruct justice, and we can't expect that the regular goings-on of the Justice Department will be able to get to the bottom of it. So on its very face, it is an absurd thing to say. But we also know that in particular, even when you have a special counsel, presidents have been known to varying degrees, attempt to influence what's actually going on with their cases. William Barr, by the way, is not a person who's innocent of this. The Iran-Contra episode, when there was a special investigator who was looking into that, William Barr himself was interfering with it. Potentially obstruction of justice. So he has seen this from the inside. The idea that a president should be immune from considerations of obstruction of justice means that in the end, what is the point of having the term in the first place? You need to have the Justice Department, which fulfills a very important role inside of the government, being relatively insulated from the political pressure of the White House. If there is no consideration of whether a president has committed obstruction of justice, then just have Donald Trump be his own attorney general. Have him just decide on a whim what the fate of various investigations will be. And William Barr is a guy who should know far more about this than any pundit or analyst like me. He knows the history of this. He knows the philosophical issues with what he's stating. But if we could put up that first graphic again, I want to mention this from one other angle. So Mueller should not be able to demand that the president submit to an interrogation about alleged obstruction. If embraced by the department, this theory would have potentially disastrous implications. No, if your theory were embraced by the department, that would have disastrous implications. And not only for the presidency and for the executive branch, but I would say the goings-on of the entirety of the US government. You can't have unilateral control over ethics investigations, investigations of corruption, other illegal acts. In this case, it's targeting, you know, the president and his inner and outer circle. But in the future, what if it was the Speaker of the House? What if it was the leadership of the Senate? What if it was a cabinet department head? And you had the president deciding who gets to investigate and who gets to be investigated without any independent input whatsoever. Then you don't have a president. You effectively have a king, at least in the most corrupt sense. So that is just one excerpt of his memo. There were other issues too, including why he sent it in the first place. Why was William Barr, a guy who holds no position, hasn't been involved in politics in an intimate fashion in far more than, I would say, 1 to 2 decades, why is he getting involved in this? Well, Barr's memo to not only Rod Rosenstein and Assistant Attorney General Stephen Engel, who leads the Office of Legal Counsel, as well as one unnamed lawyer for Donald Trump, by the way, was completely unsolicited, according to an official at the Justice Department. The official said that Barr had, quote, no non-public information about the special counsel's investigation when preparing the memorandum, and still has none, by the way. I like that as a little addition. He wrote it as a former official when he was a law firm partner and a private citizen. So, look, there were a lot of people, I guess, over the past couple of years who've written op-eds, people who have pontificated about this investigation. So it's not like no one has just given their opinion unsolicited. I'm sure Donald Trump isn't interested in my opinion. But to write a 20-page legal memo, a critical analysis of the ongoing investigation, when you have no direct attachment to it, that I would count as quite bizarre. Now, Barr concludes his memo by saying that he's in the dark about many facts, but that the obstruction inquiry was fatally misconceived. He adds, by the way, that Trump asking Comey to let go of the investigation into Michael Flynn and later firing Comey were within his powers as head of the executive branch. There are two issues there. In the second part, that it's within his powers, yes, under normal circumstances, he is allowed to fire the head of the FBI if he wants to. But it is possible that he does so in a fashion that is clear obstruction of justice. And if he fires him to shut down an investigation, especially after going to the head of the FBI and then asking for a pledge of loyalty, that is just classic textbook obstruction of justice. And again, William Barr should know that. But just consider the hubris, the arrogance of this man saying, I'm in the dark about many facts, and yet I think it was fatally misconceived. Is that sort of person, a person with such a loose conception of legal theory, of how these investigations should be run, of the relationship between people like him and potential attorney generals to these investigations, if it's that loose, is that someone who should be heading the Justice Department? Even if you don't care about the Mueller investigation, even if you want to put that totally to the side, all of the other job responsibilities that William Barr would have as AG, do you want this sort of person heading that up? If he thinks this about the Mueller investigation, what would he think about the way that the federal government gets involved in state drug laws? I mean, let alone investigations of voter fraud and all these other issues. This is a purely partisan person who popped up after being off in the political shadows for far more than a decade, comes back and gives a 20-page unsolicited opinion about an issue that he knows that if he is very strongly out in front on, potentially Donald Trump maybe gives him a job. And that's where we will close this. So they want you to believe that this 20-page memo, which was shared with the White House, Donald Trump either wasn't familiar with it or that it didn't influence his choice of William Barr. Do you really think that that is the case? Do you think that that's the case when we have Whitaker in the position right now as acting AG? A guy who has no qualification for any legal position whatsoever in the country, now heading the Department of Justice after spending a year and a half going on cable news and talking about how the Mueller investigation should be shut down. With that guy as the acting AG, do you really believe that Donald Trump was unaware that this massive memo was going around the White House saying that the investigation should be shut down and obstruction of justice isn't a thing anymore? Now, I will grant you that Donald Trump certainly didn't read the 20-page legal memo. That is virtually impossible. But I am sure that he got the spark notes handed to him. And he understood the general thrust, the general thesis of that message, even if he doesn't know what thesis means. So they will have you believe that he wasn't familiar with it. But it was floating around there. His own lawyer for the investigation had it. Donald Trump, of course, talked with his lawyers about who should be the head of the Justice Department while this investigation is ongoing. Obviously, that is the case. But you will be deceived about that ongoing. Now, Chuck Schumer is saying that since he hasn't been formally nominated yet with this new information, the president must immediately reconsider and find another nominee who is free of conflicts and will carry out the duties of the office impartially. That's a good statement, I guess. Good luck in convincing Donald Trump to do that without a lot more public pressure than that. And will Chuck Schumer actually turn those words into action? Will he refuse to cooperate with Donald Trump, you know, in advance of this possible government shutdown that we're in the middle of right now over this sort of issue? That remains to be seen, but I have to say that I am doubtful. Okay, now with that, we do have to take our first break. We come back, lots more domestic news to get to. We'll see you on the other side.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic. Or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We return to the damage report with some breaking news. It's just been, I've been informed, today's not Friday. I'm gonna be honest with you, dear viewers. I'm leaving today for holiday. And so for me, I'm gone. The weekend starts the second this show is over. And that has definitely colored my commentary today. So if you've started to question your grasp on reality, I assure you I was not gaslighting you. I just have a tenuous grasp on reality myself. Today is in fact Thursday. Tomorrow, Brett will be hosting a regular live episode of The Damage Report, so don't miss that, okay? That said, we continue.
You stay classy, San Diego.
I'm not Ron Burgundy, and there's no teleprompter. Anyway, today is Thursday. I'm Johnny DiRollo. We are in America on the material plane. And with that, we turn back to the news. I want to turn now to something that is not news. It's not new, but I saw it on Twitter, and I thought it was hilarious. Back in 1991, the New York Daily News had an article about Donald Trump allegedly foiling a mugging. Now, that might sound unlikely, but that's not the unlikely thing about the story. The unlikely thing about the story is that Donald Trump was reluctant to talk about it. It had to be pulled out of him by the reporter at the New York Daily News. So this occasionally pops up every once in a while. Somehow I had not seen it until now. If we could bring up this picture, you're going to see a picture from the original article at the New York Daily News. Muggers trumped. Donald stops attack. And it only gets more awful after that. So it starts off, call it the Donald to the rescue. No, I will not. When he saw a big guy with a big bat bashing another fellow, Donald Trump did what any self-respecting billionaire would do. He ordered his driver to pull over. Quote, I'm not looking to play this thing up. I'm surprised you found out about it. Donald Trump was surprised that the reporter found out about this and didn't want to play it up. It was just, hey, I'm a good Samaritan, and I guess I'll talk about it if you want. So here is what some people apparently said about the incident. Witnesses said Trump, with Marla Maples tugging at his arm to try to stop him, leaped from his black stretch limousine Monday evening during the assault on 9th Ave near 45th Street. So allegedly, he sees a guy beating someone over the head with a baseball bat from his limo, has the limo stop, and then runs up. The guy recognizes that he's Donald Trump, and for that reason stops beating the guy, and they have a conversation. That is what Donald Trump reluctantly says happened. But did it actually happen? So one named witness asserted that the would-be mugger had already run off by the time Trump exited his limo, and the billionaire did nothing more than join a crowd of onlookers after the fact. Well, how could that be? Donald Trump, the do-gooder, just described how he reluctantly got out and stopped this. In fact, his wife, Marla Maples, she was trying to stop him from doing it. Donald, no, you could get hit over the head too. But according to the witnesses there, he saw an incident, there was a crowd, and he joined it. Now, another anonymous witness supported Trump's account, maintaining that the bat wielder had apparently dropped his weapon after being verbally confronted. So that is possible. It's also possible that a crowd of people were yelling at this guy, and that is why he dropped his bat. The interesting thing about all of this is that police say that the attack was never actually reported to them. So at this point, I don't know if he actually, against all odds, put his body on the line to protect a fellow New Yorker, didn't want credit for it, and had to be approached by a reporter who found out about it from who exactly? Who exactly told them that? But fine, goes up to him, and the guy who is beat over the head just decided to go about his day. That's possible. That might have actually existed. But I kind of find it a little bit hard to believe, and I'll describe why in one moment. I just want to give credit first to Ken Klippenstein, friend of the show, who in response to a tweet about this tweeted back, he was that kid in grade school who said the reason his father was never around was because he worked for the CIA. That's definitely the case. And bear in mind, the reason I'm so suspicious about this is that Donald Trump, as you can see in this article, masqueraded as a publicist to brag about himself. So at this time, Donald Trump was calling up these outlets. I think his name was John Barron, he would give. Later names his son after his alter ego. How bizarre is that? And would pretend to be a publicist talking about the exploits of Donald Trump when it was actually him. So I will say this. I don't know what happened with the mugging. I find it hard to believe that Donald Trump was willing to possibly be beaten by a bat to protect this guy. But I know this. Donald Trump definitely called the New York Daily News. That is why there's this fawning review. And if you don't care about this, I totally understand it. It's not an important story. But this sort of story, writ large, over the late 80s, throughout the 90s, into the 2000s, is how we had Donald Trump at all. It's the reason that you knew who he was and you didn't know who Jared Kushner's dad was. Also, partially because he was in jail for some of that time. But it was this sort of fawning coverage, unquestioning, uncritical coverage that made him seem like this bigger than life figure. It's the reason he got The Apprentice in the first place. There are any number of billionaires that could have hosted that show, but this is a guy who was able to sell himself, whether it's on real estate or whether it's on vigilante justice. Anyway, let's move on to some other breaking news. One of the issues with the 2016 Democratic primary was that there weren't that many debates, actually. There was only a handful, actually. And so by the time you got through the debates, how much did the people really know about the two head candidates, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders? By the time you were done with all the debates, there was still a huge stretch of primaries. And so there was less opportunities for people to be like have their opinions updated through the course of those primaries and potentially vote a different way. Well, a lot of progressives were really pissed off that there weren't that many debates during that primary and have wanted that next time around. They want there to be more. And it looks like they're going to get what they want, because in 2020, the Democrats are apparently going to hold a dozen debates. But that's not the headliner. The headliner is those dozen debates are going to start in June 2019. That is, well, I would guess how many months, but I also don't know what day it is. So that's not that many months from now it's going to start. That is absurdly early by presidential, you know, election standards. In 2008, that election, when it was Hillary Clinton versus Barack Obama, their first debate was in April 2007. We're starting almost a full year early. And by the way, if they set the first debate as June of 2019, it's not like you find out who's running when they walk on the stage. If they want to be on that stage, that means they need to announce even earlier. They need to start to generate press coverage. They need to start traveling around the country. They need to be on cable news. So by setting the first debate for June 2019, that means the primary starts later today. And more people are going to be declaring. It is going to be taking up more and more news coverage, which is a good and a bad thing. For me, as a person who's obsessed with this stuff, I like talking about it. I will cover it. I'll try to get them on the show. That'll be great. But it's also going to crowd out a lot of other news that would otherwise be featured on shows like this, and especially cable news and on the New York Times and all of that. Instead, there's going to be far more horse race. So we're going to do what we can at the Damage Report to do a good balance of both, you know, our due diligence in terms of the substance as well as the politicking that's going on. But this is definitely going to shape the race. I can't say at this point who it's going to benefit, the more established candidates, or maybe it gives time for people who don't have as much of a national profile. We'll be doing future commentary about that. But this is a gigantic bomb planted right in the middle of this primary season, and we don't know exactly how it's going to play out at this point. Okay, with that, we are going to take a break. We'll be back after this later on Thursday. Welcome back to the show, everyone. We turn now to what's happening in DC. We are in crunch time right now in terms of who is going to end up on some of the most influential committees in Congress. We've been pushing all week for some of the best new incoming freshmen and freshwomen, Congress. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, you've got Katie Porter and others. To not only be in Congress, to not only be on committees, but be on the influential committees, especially the big money committees, that are going to determine what legislation actually has a chance of passing and being implemented once this new Congress actually takes power. So here is the next phase of that. There is representatives of 13 different progressive organizations. They have bundled up petition signatures, 150,000 of them, to get these key progressives onto the key committees, and they're actually going to be marching on Capitol Hill to Nancy Pelosi's office and delivering them, showing how much support there is for these committee placements. Now, as House Speaker designate, Pelosi heads a four-person steering and policy committee that doles out committee assignments to members of the House's Democratic majority. The steering and policy committee has decided on committee chairmanships, but has yet to meet to discuss other senior roles, let alone the distribution of seats for rank and file members, which means that we still have an opportunity. Nobody thought that some of these new congressmen would be getting on like the chairmanships of these positions. Obviously, there is still seniority. It is going to take some time. That is a battle for a future day. At some point, we'll do a video where we push for AOC to become the chairman of House Ways and Means. We're not there just yet, but we do want her to get onto that committee and understand that there's a little bit of extra leverage in this particular case. So in exchange for its support for her speakership, the co-chairs of the Congressional Progressive Caucus already secured a commitment from Pelosi that their members would have proportional representation, 40% of the seats on the four money panels and the Intelligence Committee. This was, I know a lot of people were frustrated with the Congressional Progressive Caucus for ever supporting Nancy Pelosi at all, but they certainly got some good stuff for their support. So proportional representation on those committees, that is strong. I mean, they are an increasingly large committee in terms of membership. This means that if they can keep this going in the future, as we elect more and more progressives, we will naturally take over those committees. Very important. Now, here is what you can do, actually. So those petitions are already going in. That is going to be great physical evidence for the movement that we are supporting. But there also has to be a digital component. And so if we could bring up this graphic, you're going to see that the Justice Democrats have been pushing throughout this week for key committee placements. And they have a website, justicedemocrats.com/key committees. Now, once you go there, you're going to get social media information, contact information that you can reach out to people like Nancy Pelosi and other influential voices in this process. And there are some suggested placements there. That is what, you know, those representatives would like. That is what the Justice Democrats would like. You might have other suggestions as well. But I can say that if we were able to get those, how powerful would that be? Ro Khanna on Ways and Means. I mean, he's been on the show multiple times. He is a big thinker, huge ideas, huge progressive policy goals. Pramila Jayapal, one of the best progressives in Congress right now. Her being on Judiciary and Ways and Means means that she would have incredible power, not only over investigations of the White House going forward in this next session, but also in shaping and crafting legislation as well. And AOC, she needs to be on Ways and Means. That is going to let her turn her ideas into action, put pressure on people in these committee meetings, make sure that it makes news. That should be our goal right now. So please do me a favor, do them a favor, do yourself a favor. Go to justicedemocrats.com/key committees and help them get on those committees now. With that, we turn to other news. We've been talking about Tucker Carlson is having some issues with sponsors. Now, over the weekend, he said that the mass immigration that America is experiencing, and by the way, has experienced throughout its history, he leaves that part out, is leading to us to be not only weaker, the sorts of general rhetoric that right-wingers use, but also dirtier. He specifically said it makes America dirtier, and a lot of people had a problem with that. And thanks to activists like Jordan Yule, who was on the program earlier this week, a number of sponsors have dropped out of his show. They're not advertising on his show anymore after a social media push. So he's receiving a lot of pushback. The list is getting longer and longer. We're not going to show you the whole thing, but I mean, IHOP has now pulled their ads, SodaStream, Samsung, SanDisk, NerdWallet, Minted, Ancestry, Jaguar. A lot of big companies are no longer advertising there. And he's getting a lot of criticism. But he's not just getting criticism from the left, by the way. Even crazed whack jobs like Alan Dershowitz, appearing on his show yesterday, had this to say.
Tucker, I just want to make one point. I hope you don't mind me making it. Boycotts and attempts. I hate boycotts and attempts to censor free speech. I'm in favor of complete dialogue. But as such, I feel impelled to tell you that I, with due respect, disagree with the way you categorize mass immigration. That's all. I just want to say that.
Well, that's okay. And by the way, would expect that you would. We differ probably on a lot of issues, but mm-hmm. the one issue that we agree on and that I respect you for is your willingness to say what you think in public, to defend your views, to have a conversation, and mm-hmm. to let others decide which side is right. And that's something that I wish we were able to do a lot more of.
Okay, so we're gonna have a little bit more of the video for you. If you were to watch the entire thing, it devolves into that, you know, into the internet dark web stuff of these are the only true free speech advocates. He claims there, as literally every single right winger these days in media claims, that his show is the only place where people can come and say what they actually think. Well, that is great that he has set up that shrine to free speech. Alan Dershowitz there. Alan Dershowitz is a bad guy. He's a gigantic defender of Donald Trump. It's a guy that's been implicated in multiple of Jeffrey Epstein's crimes. Another woman just came out just this week with accusations against Alan Dershowitz. So that said, the fact that he's even criticizing Tucker Carlson is certainly interesting, even though in so doing, he's advancing a lot of the same BS, like I would say pro-conservative mythology that Tucker Carlson does on a daily basis. So he says, I'm against censorship. Okay, that's fine. You can have that peripheral concern that has nothing to do with this, but he's bringing it up as if it has something to do with this. Who is being censored in this? What is the attempt at censorship? Let's say Jordan Yule and his activism effort that they have been pushing for, are they trying to get him taken off the air? Are they saying that the government should step in and should ban his show? Should he be locked up? Should they tape over his mouth? Who is censoring Tucker Carlson? All they're saying is, we want to know the companies that are going out of their way, choosing your show and handing over huge checks based on you being the host of that show, do they actually agree with what you're saying? That's all we want to know. Nobody's saying that you're not allowed to say it. We're just saying that those companies are not obligated to give you money to say it. And if you believe that there can't be boycotts, which by the way, they do not believe, Fox News constantly pushes for boycotts. They were getting people to smash their Keurigs last year in terms of a boycott. So spare me the theatrics over boycotts. If you're saying that you cannot put pressure on these advertisers, the advertisers should not consider the message of a show, you're effectively saying that they have to sign on. No matter how bad what you say it is, they have to support it. So if Tucker Carlson starts advocating for a literal Nazi takeover of the country tomorrow, SodaStream can't pull their ads because that would be censorship. Does anyone really believe that? Does anyone really believe that this has anything to do with censorship whatsoever? Tucker Carlson can and will say whatever he wants, but he doesn't necessarily have to be paid extra for it. And a lot of people who consume these products, they want to know, is this a thing that your company actually supports? And by the way, I want to go one step further on this because I saw Nate Silver on Twitter was saying, you know, I have to say that I'm really concerned about the way this is going too, because if we put pressure on all these advertisers that they whatever they advertise on, they implicitly agree with every component of it, then the only thing that corporations will advertise on will be incredibly pro-corporate positions. Now, that at face value sounds like, oh, well, I don't want advertising to only go to shows that are super pro-corporate. But that's not what we're talking about here. That is a ridiculous straw man. How many successful boycotts of advertisers have there been over the past 5 years, we'll say? And what was the stimulus for them? What actually led to successful boycott efforts like this one, like Glenn Beck experienced, like Bill O'Reilly experienced? Was it in opposition to their positions on the fair tax? Was it opposition to their position on fracking? No. In all of these cases, with Glenn Beck, it was spreading anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. With Bill O'Reilly, it was the fact that he's apparently serially molested and sexually assaulted a number of different women. And with Tucker Carlson, it's outright advocacy for anti-immigrant language, calling them dirtier and all of that. These aren't policy concerns. This is just demonizing a group based on them being in that group. This isn't a political difference at all. This is saying, do you support these people as people, or do you believe that I can generate a little bit of social media buzz, I can get people on the right to like my show more if I demonize this group of people? They're political concerns at all, so spare me the concerns about political free speech. You're not being sentenced and you're barely talking about politics in the first place. Anyway, we had more that we were going to say about this. We will return to it, I'm sure, the next time he spreads some white supremacist talking point. For now, we do have to take a break, though. When we come back, awesome guest is going to join us. More after this. It was just a couple of weeks ago that we had a legal opening to find out a little bit more about what was going on with Jeffrey Epstein and the charges against him. A settlement stopped us from actually learning anything in that case. But there is the possibility in the future there will be developments that will reveal more. To learn more about this case, we're going to be joined by an expert on the topic. Conchita Sarnoff is both the executive director of the Alliance to Rescue Victims of Trafficking and also the author of Trafficking, who's done a lot of research in this area. Conchita, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Very glad to have you here. So there are many people, obviously, who are not very familiar with the history of this case. You've been researching it for some time. Can you bring us up to date? Jeffrey Epstein, what is he alleged to have done?
Certainly. Well, he's actually committed human trafficking. According to the Palm Beach police reports, there were over 100 underage girls who reported crimes against children, i.e. trafficking crimes, as per the definition of the trafficking law. And Epstein was not charged, in fact, after a two-year criminal investigation with human trafficking. He was charged for one count of solicitation of prostitution with a minor. So not only did they identify the victim, the underage girl, as a prostitute, which is appalling and unheard of and illegal, they also removed most of his charges from the original indictment.
So that's the thing that's just mystified me, this entire process. The sheer number of women, it would seem like it would be a very open and shut case. Is it the case that it's just inherently hard to go anywhere with human trafficking cases, or is it something particular to Jeffrey Epstein that he was able to, despite the ever-increasing list of girls, that none of these charges really stuck, that he was able to evade any real responsibility?
I believe both. Number one, it's very difficult. I've been in the space of human trafficking. I've been working in this field for over a decade now, since 2006. And it's very, very difficult, John, to actually prosecute a trafficker, because it means that the witness, the victim, must be a witness and must come forward and go to court against the trafficker and testify. And usually children who have been traumatized in this way find it very difficult not only to relive the trauma, but also to be a witness to such a crime. That's the first issue that I think people should understand. The second issue is that given Epstein's wealth and resources, he is estimated to be worth around $2 billion. And he had a legal team that was pretty much the best legal team in the United States. The leader of that legal team was Alan Dershowitz, and following him was Gerald Lefcourt, Roy Black from Miami, Martin Weinberger, Kenneth Starr, who was, as you know, the special investigator during the Lewinsky Clinton scandal, and Jay Lefkowitz, and a slew of attorneys that just, went up against the prosecutor, and the prosecutor being the current Labor Secretary, Alex Acosta, and the prosecution team. Not only Acosta, because he's not the only one who makes those type of decisions when a prosecuting team decides to move forward on a case and prosecute a federal case, even though this ended up being a state case, not a federal case, then it's the entire United States Attorney's Office that makes those decisions. So Epstein's legal team had so many relationships at the Department of Justice in Washington, and they, I'm sure, traded in what in legalese is considered chits, chits as in, I'll do you this favor if you do me that favor, that kind of thing. So it's all about personal relationships, really. It's not about, he had the money to pay these attorneys, but more importantly, the attorneys that he chose to represent him had the resources to negotiate in Washington at the Department of Justice what the non-prosecution agreement, the NPA, which is what is right now at stake and right now being discussed.
So we recently, as I mentioned in the intro, we had a settlement related to this case not long ago. And coming out of it, I didn't learn anything new out of that case. What are the chances? What would have to happen in the future for us to either have something more approaching justice or to find out more about what actually happened?
Well, there would have to be an open investigation again. The inspector general would have to agree to reopen, or not reopen, forgive me, to investigate the non-prosecution agreement. Non-prosecution agreements are usually never overturned, and that's what would have to happen. In order for, you cannot charge someone with a crime twice. It's called double jeopardy. So, in fact, Epstein cannot be charged again for the cases that were already shut. There are several civil cases. There are two pending, one in New York, a victim named, let's call her Jane Doe 43. I don't like to reveal the names of victims, even though some other, reporters have begun to do that, but I prefer not to do that, given the trauma and the difficulty that victims have these days in helping cases resolve. So Jane Doe 43 is suing Epstein and four procurers: Ghislaine Maxwell, Sarah Haley Robson, Sarah Kellen, and one more girl. I believe, I don't want to say her name because I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly. So there's this one victim in New York in the Southern District suing Epstein and four procurers. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, that is a civil case, though. That is not a criminal case. So what the victim obviously wants his money. And the attorney representing the victim is David Boies, who is a well-known New York attorney, very friendly with the Clinton family. He was the attorney for Vice President Gore during the Bush-Gore 2000 elections. And he also represented a previous victim, Virginia Louise Roberts, who actually, she sold her story to several papers, and she's exposed herself and identified herself and been on camera. So Virginia Louise Roberts is a critical witness in the Epstein case, and she is not included in the pending New York case. But so this pending case, again, is a civil case, not a criminal case. They cannot overturn the criminal charges. So unless the inspector general decides that that the NPA is invalid, nothing will happen to Mr. Epstein unless a new victim comes forward.
So it certainly looks like there's the high bar to progress on this, but we will be watching, and hopefully something will develop. Conchita Sarnoff, thank you for joining us. Executive Director of the Alliance to Rescue Victims of Trafficking, we appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And by the way, if you'd like to learn more about her research, the book is Trafficking. It's available now. We're going to take one more break. When we come back, while we've been focusing on all this U.S. news, a lot's been going on around the world, and we're going to profile it on the other side. Did you know that as we're focused on stuff going on in America, there's actually news going on all around the world? It's time for Meanwhile In. Oh my God, Brett, you've outdone yourself. Meanwhile in Australia, nude golf. It's actually a thing for some reason. It's called the Wandering Bears event. It was organized by 69-year-old nudist Bruce Jensen and his wife Julie, who run the Brew Jewel Nudist Retreat. That is actually one of the better celebrity name mashups that I've seen. So they thought, if we could do all this other stuff while nude, why not golf? And they got a golf course to actually agree with it. Jensen said, "We presented the event before the club committee. It took months of negotiating, but they finally said we could play naked golf." And they said, though, there were two holes they were not allowed to play on because it was within sight of the clubhouse and people might complain. There's a restaurant and stuff, so you sort of understand that. And look, I have to say, I'm an outsider to the whole nudist thing. I don't really understand it. But they say that it's like you can get down in clothing, but that last bit of clothing is always going to sort of stop you from freeing yourself totally. Once you remove that last piece of material, you remove all of your inhibitions. Which is fine. But I do think that there are better and worse places to do it. The problem with golf is there's a lot of like swinging, like a lot of abrupt swinging of the body. And I think you should be supported while your body parts are swinging all over. So I don't know about that, but you know, if that's what they want to do, totally fine. I would worry about sunburn and also sand traps. That would be my second concern. So while that's going on, meanwhile in... In the deepest depths of the Marianas Trench, we have found plastic. I wish it was about like a cool fish or something, but no, it's us wrecking the environment, even in some of the most extreme parts of the environment that exist on the entire planet. Researchers plumbed the depths of the Mariana Trench in the western Pacific Ocean near Challenger Deep, the lowest place on the face of the planet. They found the highest levels of microplastics yet found in the open ocean, compared with surveys from elsewhere in the Pacific, Atlantic, and Arctic oceans. And so that's what's amazing. It's not that they found plastic there, but that even there, a place where it's very, very difficult for humans to even look, they have found higher concentrations. And so that makes me wonder, like, what other places are we not looking for pollution, whether plastic or otherwise? What other places are we stocking up sort of the cast-off remnants of our civilization in a way that is potentially endangering species that we have never seen before? How sad is that? Researchers said the microplastics in the trench were likely to come from the industrialized nations in East Asia, including China and Japan. The trench is a narrow V-shaped abyss and therefore traps sinking particles. Most of the microplastics, by the way, were fibers a few millimeters long, cast off pieces of clothing, bottles, packaging, and fishing gear. But what's amazing about that is we like to think that at some point we can go through the ocean and we can clean it up. But the thing is that plastic doesn't stay in its original form. It gets broken down. And that's how you end up with just millimeters long shards. That's going to be so much harder to clean, let alone down in the Marianas Trench where we're never actually going to be able to do that. Meanwhile, Lynn. Meanwhile, in the UK, drones are disrupting the holiday plans of thousands and thousands of Brits. So a drone was just flying around an airport, and the issue with that is, if there's drones nearby, you can't take off. It's holiday time. There's lots of people who would love to be in a plane at that point. The police in Sussex said it was not terror related, but a deliberate act of disruption using industrial specification drones. I don't know what that means. I'm imagining they're larger and more dangerous if they were to slam into a plane. About 110,000 passengers on 760 flights were due to fly on Thursday. Disruption could last several days. And if it does, that is just going to disrupt so many people's holiday plans. Drones are going to be great for a lot of different things. I saw another story where they were delivering medicine to remote islands via drones. But also in irresponsible people's hands, it's just a disaster. Meanwhile, in way off in the year 2220, finally, economic opportunity between men and women will finally be equal. That is according to a World Economic Forum set of research. So they're tracking the progress we've made on equality, how fast things are improving. It's very slow, so it will literally take centuries. But if we reach that point, it'll be good news for us. That said, we are done for today. But today is just Thursday, so there is a show tomorrow, and we'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.